Hey, it's Francis. This week, we're going back to an episode we made last year after I watched this incredible documentary called Fantastic Fungi, and it's about how mushrooms are basically like the most amazing life form on Earth. Anyway, check it out. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Look, I'll be the first person to tell you that I have weird taste in movies. I don't mean like cool weird, like I only watch Spanish surrealist art films, but just absolutely random weird. Like for a 3-year period, for no apparent reason, the only movies I watched were all about Mongolia. Now, they weren't bad movies, but I guess what I'm saying is I am not a film connoisseur. Still, I want to tell you about this movie I saw the other day. A documentary about mushrooms called Fantastic Fungi. Yes, I literally just said a documentary about mushrooms. Anyway, it was incredible to look at. There were all these just mesmerizing stop-motion videos of mushrooms sprouting and devouring things. And like half the movie is about how mushrooms can literally save the world and also replace your therapist. And by the end, you're like, I, for one, welcome our new mushroom overlords. But then I remembered, wait, we get to eat them before they eat us, which is where the Fantastic Fungi cookbook comes in. Yes, the documentary about mushrooms has a companion cookbook, and it's terrific. The author, Eugenia Bone, is a longtime wild food expert, food writer, nature journalist, and she collected and tested over 100 mushroom recipes submitted by mushroom hunters, mycologists, chefs, and fungi fans from all over. And she's here with us now. Hey, Eugenia, it's great to have you.
Hi, Francis. It's great to be on.
You know, you have long been an expert on mushrooms, but you say you learned a lot from compiling this community cookbook from mushroom hunters and mushroom lovers. So I'm so excited to get into, you know, what amazed even someone as experienced as yourself. But I kind of want to start on a basic level because I kind of feel like that's where I am.
All right.
I love mushrooms. But the way I realize the way I tend to use them is pretty limited in that I pretty much always, you know, just kind of cut or tear them into small bite-sized pieces. And whether I'm roasting them in the oven or searing them in a pan, it's pretty much the same thing. I'm just pretty much trying to brown the bejesus out of them. So first of all, why is that so delicious? And second, like, can you help me understand that that is not, in fact, the only way to cook mushrooms?
Right? I mean, I did the same thing until I started this book. I tended to cook mushrooms not that many ways, but the beauty of doing a community cookbook is a lot of different mushrooms cooking styles were coming across my stove, if you will. And so it was really illuminating for me. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to cook mushrooms. But one thing that's in common about all the mushrooms is the type of flavors you can expect. And that's generally characterized as umami, a kind of meaty savoriness that some people think may be coming out of the proteins, the amino acids that are present in mushrooms. And that sort of meaty savoriness is very similar to meats, to beef and chicken and fish and so on. So mushrooms can actually be cooked in many of the ways that meats are cooked versus the ways vegetables are cooked. So it's a kind of interesting rethink of how to approach mushrooms.
Yeah, you have this really interesting note in the book that mushrooms are, in fact, more like meat than vegetables.
Yeah.
Both from a culinary point of view and almost from like a biological point of
Absolutely.
View.
Absolutely. So fungi, which mushrooms are the fruiting bodies, the sort of organs of sexual reproduction of fungi. And fungi are closer on the tree of life to animals than they are to plants. So there's some things they have in common with plants, but when you cook them up, they're different in a lot more ways.
So when you were putting this book together, what were some of the most surprising ways to use mushrooms that you came across?
I guess one of the biggest takeaways for me, Francis, was you can really cook mushrooms pretty hard. You know, you'd think something, a mushroom like an enoki, which is really like a little slender nail, you know, these very delicate
almost mushrooms. Like noodles.
Yeah, like the little noodles.
Like thin noodles. Yeah.
They can be cooked for quite a long time or multiple times and still retain their integrity, their texture and form. So, for example, there's a delicious enoki miso tofu soup, a really simple Japanese style soup in the book. And I made the soup. It was and I had the enoki in it, of course, in it, and it was delicious. And then the next day I had some leftover and I also had some clams. So I thought, well, just for my own purposes, I'll recook the soup, only I'll add clams. I thought for sure those enoki were going to become like limp and just this nothing. You know, they would just dissolve.
Yeah.
No, they retain their mouthfeel, their bite beautifully. So it was a real lesson as to the ability of mushrooms to withstand heat, especially wet heat.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me more. Okay, so like here you're talking about a mushroom you might simmer in a soup for longer than you'd expect. What kind of avenues did it open up for you in terms of cooking mushrooms?
So they can also take like an enormous amount of heat. I mean, you can, depending, you know, again, on the morphology, like if you slice a maitake or you slice a, you know, a big kind of beefy, if you will, porcini mushroom and put it on the grill, it's going to hold itself together. It's not going to be as delicate as a vegetable. It's going to really act more like a piece of meat with that intense heat. And I also realized that mushrooms don't need fat to be cooked. You can dry cook them and then add fat for flavor, or you can dry cook them and then add water and do a boil on them and then add fat for flavor if that's your bag. So the idea that you need fat to cook mushrooms is just forget it. You don't.
Oh, that's so interesting. And actually, you know, basically what I'm thinking too is, okay, if we're thinking about them as meat, well, one of the sort of eternal challenges of meat, if you're cooking meat with, you know, searing or roasting or, you know, whatever, if you're browning meat, you're always trying to find that heat level, that technique, that sweet spot of getting beautiful browning and color without overcooking the steak.
Yeah.
Right. So like that's what people are always obsessed with. And I want a medium rare center, but I want the outside to be super charred. But it sounds like if you can just kind of you just hammer mushrooms and you're not really worried about overcooking them.
No.
What that kind of says to me is you don't even need necessarily to have ripping super high heat to get that good browning. Just cook them longer.
Yeah.
And it also means you don't have to stress about like, oh, I got to get them out of the pan before they overcook. Just keep cooking them until they're brown.
Yeah.
And they develop that beautiful sweetness and umami. And so, yeah, you don't have to stress about it.
No. I mean, it's really a great idea with people who are just starting out with new species to cook some specimens plainly so that you can taste them, because there are a lot of distinguishing flavors. You know, mushrooms really have a whole spectrum of flavors, and to treat all mushrooms like the white button, the Agaricus bisporus, is a little bit of a, you know, you sort of don't do yourself as a cook justice. So it's helpful, I think, to cook a little bit and taste it and get an idea of where that flavor might go. So like, for example, a chanterelle, if you cook it a little bit and taste it, you'll see that they often have a kind of apricot-y flavor. So then next place your mind can go, and what a lot of the recipes in the Fantastic Fungi Cookbook, what those authors have done is they've collected these mushrooms and they said, you know, I taste the apricots, so I'm going to cook those chanterelles with apricots and, you know, in a pork dish, for example. So that's avenue by which I think a lot of these recipes and the way the home cooks, the mycophiles, you know, the folks that go out and collect mushrooms and develop recipes at home, this is how they come about their recipes. That and, of course, whatever their ethnic background is that might already predispose them to certain kinds of flavors with mushrooms.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Okay, I definitely want to get into more hands-on what to do with mushroom stuff later. But since you're bringing up, you know, the contributors to your book and just, you know, mycologists, mushroom hunters, mushroom lovers in general, this is a real subculture.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about this world. Well, tell me how you got into it, first of all.
So I'm a longtime food writer, and I have always been into wild foods, into the tastes of wild foods. And I've always enjoyed hunting of different types. But in general, I prefer looking for things that hide versus chasing things that flee. So mushrooms are perfect. And it's also, it's a, you know, wonderful way to be out in nature. And there's, it's, there's all different opportunities to go mushroom hunting. In order to find wild mushrooms, it's helpful to know a little bit about why they grow, when and where. So I started to do some very basic research into, you know, how to find porcini mushrooms, for example. And that led to me joining the New York Mycological Society. And I would recommend that for any of your listeners who want to learn about collecting wild mushrooms. Turns out there's mushroom clubs all over the country, and they're pretty easy to find. You can just go to the North American Mycological Association, NAMA, and you go to their website and look under clubs, and they list all the clubs in the United States.
Oh, cool.
And you can find one. And so mycological clubs, they're kind of like birding clubs. You know, it's a hobby. It's a hobby club, but it's this fantastic marriage of science and gastronomy. So if you're into food and you're into nature, mycology is for you.
We're talking to Eugenia Bone, author of The Fantastic Fungi Community Cookbook. She'll be back with more on mushrooms in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, so we're talking about the magic of mushrooms with Eugenia Bone, author of The Fantastic Fungi Community Cookbook. Let's get back to it with her. So, Eugenia, you know, we're talking about mushroom hunting, and people get just really super passionate about it, right? Like, what do you think about it, like, sparks that passion, where people, like, start to organize their whole lives around?
And there is, like, serious passion. It's really, it's so kooky and so wonderful and inspiring. There'll be people from all walks of life, you know, plumbers and investment bankers and artists and kids and old people, you know, really the demographic is wide. And from what I can tell, the real motivating factor, at least the starter motivating factor, is the excitement, the endorphin rush of the hunt.
Yeah.
There's this moment when you're walking in the woods and you see nothing and nothing and nothing and you're looking and nothing's happening. And then, for whatever reason, your eye falls on a mushroom, the pattern recognition sets into your brain, and it's like the forest has lifted her skirts and showed you this hidden or unseen world of mushrooms erupting underneath all the trees. And it is ecstatic. And maybe it turns on some lizard brain thing in us that, you know, goes back to our earliest hunter-gatherer roots where we were very happy when we found food. But it truly is an exciting and fun and sort of an intense experience. People love it. Once you start finding mushrooms, wow, it's so much fun to go out in the woods.
Yeah, yeah. I've only been maybe once or twice, and years and years and years ago. But hearing you describe that totally brings me back to that walk I took. You know, like it awesome. Really was like, you're just kind of like, what? Like, I know I'm supposed to be looking for this thing. And bang, all of a sudden there's one. And then there's two. And then there's a whole ring of them.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a new lens is put on your vision.
Yes.
It's like you're seeing what was right in front of your face.
What you didn't see before.
A totally different way.
It feels miraculous.
It's thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable mushroom find you remember?
I love going to the Sierra Nevadas to hunt burn morels in the spring. And I do that every year that I can because of the grandness of nature and the ubiquitousness of the morels. I mean, it's not even really hunting. It's more like collecting. It's more like just harvesting.
Some garbage bags.
It's just rush upon rush upon rush. I mean, I've seen things like, elk footprints going off into the distance and the morel in every one. I mean, it felt like it was gonna find them forever. You know, it was just never gonna end. So all those kind of exciting experiences are I treasure and try to repeat because the seasons come back and it's possible.
Right on. Okay, so we also had lots of questions about preparing, enjoying, buying mushrooms at home, foraged or store-bought, and thought you'd be a great person to take them on with us.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, let me go through some of these that we got in.
Okay.
One is, what's the difference between tan mushrooms and white ones?
So I'm guessing you're thinking about the cremini versus white button mushrooms, for example?
I assume so, yeah.
So they're the same species. They're just different colors. there is very little difference except for whatever is making, you know, whatever genetic factor is making the cremini brown versus the white button white. But they are the same species. And in fact, the portobello, the cremini, and the white button mushroom, they're all the same species, Agaricus bisporus. It's just that a cremini is brown and a portobello is a mature cremini.
Okay.
So that's why you can see all the spore, you know, why they have the gills filled with spore underneath, because it's mature. But they're all the same as far as the taxonomy is concerned. When your mushrooms come in all kinds of different colors and shapes, we use it those qualities to identify the mushrooms, not so much to send us in a direction flavor-wise.
Okay. That was a very politic way of saying, if you're paying more money for cremini mushrooms because you think they taste better, it's probably in your head.
You know, it's like brown eggs versus white eggs.
Okay,
it's kind of the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's another question. When I'm buying mushrooms in a store, what should I be looking for in terms of color, firmness, et cetera? Is there a way to predict mushroom flavor by shape and color? So you sort of cover that a little bit.
Well, I can elaborate a bit
because
that's a really good question. I mean, here's the thing. So the mushroom is like the fruit or the flower of the fungus, right? It's the organ of sexual reproduction. So when you're selecting mushrooms that you see in the grocery store, think of the same sort of standards that you would hold a bouquet of flowers or a few apples to. I mean, if they're dehydrated, if they're wrinkly, or if they're rotting, you know, or they smell sulfurous, you know, have off smells, then, you know, don't purchase them. You're looking for a firm, moist, and aromatic specimens, you know, aromatic mushrooms. And then when you get it home, that's another question. How do you take care of them? They're a lot like berries in the way they behave in the fridge. You know, if you wash your mushrooms and put them in a plastic bag in the fridge, what's going to happen? They're going to bloom with mold. So what everyone recommends, all the chefs that I've talked to over the years, is don't wash them, put them in a paper bag, and you can hold them in the fridge for quite a few days and then wash them before preparing.
Okay, so you're using a big word, wash, because that's, for whatever reason, that's always the controversial thing.
I know.
You can't wash mushrooms. They soak them all up and they make the mushrooms flavorless. But you're telling us to wash them.
No, wash your mushrooms for sure. I mean, cultivated mushrooms you want to wash because in some cases, the farmers will put insecticides on the mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, you know, mushrooms from the field need to be washed because they usually have forest debris or little bugs in them. And God, one time I opened up a morel and there was like a 3-inch salamander in there. Definitely you want to wash.
You took us home.
I was like, what? But some of them are more delicate and so you have to wash carefully, and others are more robust and you can really, you know, agitate them a lot in water to get rid of any debris. But the bottom line is most of the time, and this is one of the authors in the book, this guy Chad Hyatt, had what he said to me, he goes, most of the time we're collecting mushrooms in the rain. You know, of course they can get wet.
That's so funny. Like, I totally didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, you mentioned putting them in a paper bag. I often buy my mushrooms at the farmer's market. I notice that they put them in paper bags rather than plastic. But when you buy supermarket mushrooms, usually they're in like a container with, you know, plastic wrap around them. But you actually should take them out of the plastic because it can affect the flavor.
So what I think the problem is in leaving mushrooms in plastic is, you know, the environment of the fridge is actually rather dry. And so the mushrooms will perspire. They'll produce water because they're mostly water anyway. You know, they're like 70% water. So they'll perspire all this water, which then is encased in plastic and creates the conditions where mold could grow. So okay. It just accelerates rotting. That said, you can also have the opposite problems. Like if you leave your mushrooms in a paper bag too long in the fridge, they're going to get kind of shriveled and dry, and they'll taste, when you cook them, the mouthfeel will be kind of tough and chewy. And that's because part of the cell wall of mushrooms is made of something called chitin. And chitin is a type of sugar that is the same stuff present in like shrimp shells. It's one of the things that mushrooms have in common with animals. And so that chitin is really pretty tough stuff. It's one of the reasons why mushrooms, which are mostly water, can push through soil and not fall apart. You know,
interesting. Yeah.
Even asphalt. You might have seen some mushrooms pushing through asphalt on the side of the road. Well, it's the chitin that allows that to happen. And but if the mushrooms are drying out in your fridge, the ratio of water in the mushroom to chitin in the mushroom changes where, you know, there's less water. Mm-hmm, so relatively speaking, more chitin. And that creates a chewier, harder mushroom.
Oh, interesting. All right. So here's the last one. So dried mushrooms. You know, I grew up in a Chinese home where basically the only mushroom we cared about were dried shiitakes.
Yeah.
Never fresh.
Excellent.
Always dried. But I think there's a sense that like, oh, dried isn't as good as fresh. Tell us about dried mushrooms, how to rehydrate them, and what are ones you really like?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways to preserve mushrooms. They all can be frozen. Usually we parboil them or partially saute them until they give up their water and then put them in baggies and freeze them. You can do that with any mushroom. And then there's a group of mushrooms that love to be dried. Shiitake are one, porcini are another, morels. These are mushrooms that some people will say are even more tasty when the dried mushroom is rehydrated. Other mushrooms like chanterelle, they don't dry as well. They tend to become kind of chewy and the mouthfeel isn't as nice when you rehydrate them. So there's a little bit of variation from species to species when it comes to preservation techniques. You can pickle many mushrooms as well. And you can also water bath can pickled mushrooms or marinated mushrooms, and you can pressure can mushrooms. But the USDA data only exists for white buttons, unfortunately.
Okay.
When it comes to rehydrating, and we have in the book many, many recipes that call for fresh, and then there's also the dried mushroom version, you know, because in some cases people aren't going to get fresh porcini, but they could use dried in the recipe if they can. But here's something that I learned from this book that really was a bit of an eye-opener for me, and that is, you don't have to rehydrate in water. You can rehydrate in any liquid. You can rehydrate in the liquid that you're going to use in the dish, and all you'll do is pump up that flavor even more. I mean, we have one recipe where this fellow, Charles Luce, he's from Weehawken, New Jersey, and what he does is he puts dried porcini mushrooms in a pint jar with cream, and then he puts that in a low, low oven, or you can sous vide it as if you have one of those contraptions. But he puts it, I mean, it works in a low, low oven, and a few hours later, you get these beautifully rehydrated porcini mushrooms and this cream. Oh my God, it is so unctuous and just redolent with porcini flavor, and it's a wonderful product to use. What he does is he paints it onto the inside of turkey breasts and then does a little roularde and roasts it up.
Oh, I mean, wow. That sounds wild.
Wow. And so, yeah, you can hydrate in wine. You can hydrate in stock. You could hydrate in apple cider. You know, the sky is the limit.
I love it. That sounds super awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I actually have some dried mushrooms in my pantry right now that I'm going to go play with to make dinner.
Excellent.
So thank you so much, Eugenia. This was really wonderful.
My pleasure. Glad to talk about mushrooms anytime.
Eugenia Bone is the author of the Fantastic Fungi Community Cookbook. She left us her recipe for Lake Prespa baked mushrooms from anthropologist Naini Penlogia. It's mushrooms cooked with tomatoes, peppers, wine, with feta on top. It's great. It's at splendidtable.org. Okay, so I started this episode by talking about a documentary about mushrooms where the fungi were really the star, but what about the people who pick them and the people who pay for them and eat them and love them? Well, Anna Lohenhaupt-Singh is a professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz, and she started asking those questions when she began learning about the matsutake mushroom and found a fascinating story about refugees and economics and destruction and rebirth. Her book is The Mushroom at the End of the World. Hey, Dr. Singh, it's so great to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on your show.
No, I'm super excited because I have to say I love that you've written a book on matsutakes, which are, I mean, I guess if I would have the chance to eat them, like even once a year, they would be my favorite mushroom because they are so incredibly delicious, so aromatic. But I really had no idea about, you know, their whole world, as it were. So let's start with the mushroom itself. How would you describe the matsutake mushroom?
Almost everyone who loves matsutake describes it by its smell. But I'll admit, not everyone loves the smell. It's an acquired taste that in Japan, for example, people think of the smell as just bringing them into the world of the autumn, into the world of the appreciation of nature and the mountains and a whole ecology. In the United States, not everyone knows how to appreciate this mushroom. In fact, one important mushroom expert, David Aurora, has given a wonderful description of the smell as a juxtaposition, a provocative juxtaposition between red hots and dirty socks.
That's a lot less delicious than how I would think of them.
That's right. But it's a very evocative, vivid description. I myself had to go through a process of learning to love it. When I first smelled it, I did think it smelled really odd. And then as I came to work with it more, I moved into the amazing deliciousness, appreciation of the smell.
The thing I love about them, too, is how much they really smell like fresh pine to me. Not the resiny, like, you know, pine saw kind of pine, but just like the beautiful wood of the pine tree. And I just think it's, oh, God, they can be magical. So, but this is interesting because if you didn't start out as a lover of them, what got you interested in this mushroom and studying it?
I was first looking for a global commodity that hadn't been so standardized in the world that people just took it for granted, that when you think about something like wheat or coal, the commercial standards have made it very clear what kind of wheat you're supposed to grow and what kind of wheat you're allowed to sell. Well, it seemed to me that other commodities had a lot more cultural negotiations around them. And so when someone told me about matsutake, which I hadn't heard of before, I got really excited, especially since they told me a place to go in Oregon where the person said, well, you know, the buyers, they start buying in the evening after the mushroom pickers come back. So during the day, he said, they should have a lot of time to talk to you. So I went up there and I just became completely fascinated by the scene of matsutake, not only the mushroom itself with its amazing aroma, but the mushroom pickers, which include a lot of refugees from Southeast Asia, as well as white pickers, that it was just such a culturally rich scene and so exciting ecologically that, anyway, it caught my interest.
Yeah. Well, there's something really particular about the Matsutake itself, in addition to it being, well, it's connected to it being, you know, culinarily unique, and that's its value, right? They can be nearly as expensive as, you know, truffles, famously. Tell us about the history of that. Why did they become so valuable? And, you know, they're not only found in Japan, but why do we primarily know them by their Japanese name?
In Japan, they've been valued for a very long time, although not necessarily monetarily valued. Back in feudal Japan, sometimes peasants would give matsutake to their feudal lords instead of other kinds of rents or tithes. So they were always considered an aristocratic treat. But they were still very common in Japan, especially during periods when there was a lot of clearing of forests and then pine trees grew up instead, and matsutake came with the pine. So they were quite common. But then after World War II, a set of ecological changes in Japan, which surprisingly involved, among other things, abandoning some of the village forests and allowing them to grow back to ecologies that didn't support pine and didn't support matsutake. Matsutake, by the 1970s, became quite rare. It was the same time that Japan's economy boomed, and there was a lot of money going around for special treats like matsutake. And so by the late 1970s and the 1980s, that's when the price began to boom. And matsutake from around the world entered the Japanese market. People around the world, wherever there were pines and temperate forests, started looking for matsutake out in the woods to send them to Japan.
Oh, that's so interesting. And, you know, how were they viewed in these other places originally? Were they also valued, or?
It really depends on the place that some Native American groups really valued matsutake, while others did not consider it a significant mushroom. The place that really rivals Japan in its love of matsutake is Korea, partly because the forests of Korea were destroyed in the time around World War II. And so a lot of pine trees grew up in the forests that had been cut down. And so matsutake also came to life in Korea in that post-war period, and they were very much valued as a part of Korean cuisine.
We're talking with Anna Lohenhaupt-Singh, author of The Mushroom at the End of the World. We'll be back with more in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking with Anna Lohenhaupt-Singh, author of The Mushroom at the End of the World, about matsutake as one of the most delicious things on the planet, and how they may be a symbol of hope for the planet. Let's get back to our chat with her.
So you went all over the world searching for these mushrooms. You wrote about hunting for them in the Pacific Northwest, in Southeast Asia, and Lapland. What were some of your most notable memories from those journeys?
It was an incredible chance to see the world from its peripheries, that I think usually when people travel, they go to the capital city. And instead, here I was looking at these places at the margins of what we consider the centers of civilization. That when I got to Finland, for example, I started in the capital, Helsinki, and got on an overnight train and woke up in the morning in Lapland and saw this amazing landscape that I had never been to before, and where pine trees are an incredibly important part of the ecology there, a place where trees are still just coming back from the ice ages, and pines, along with birches, were some of the first trees to come there. Matsutake had become a moment in a boom economy in Lapland, where it joined collecting berries and other kinds of forest products, and people were taking classes and learning how to identify this mushroom and to get out there and look for the mushroom. So it was an exciting moment to see people's dedication to foraging in the woods. But that was just one. You know, I went to Yunnan in China. More matsutake come out of Yunnan than any other place in the world. Mm. And it's in part because the particular way that people use forests has, again, promoted pines. And these matsutake also grow with oak in Yunnan. It's exactly the same matsutake, but it turns out to be more able to combine different kinds of hosts than we might have imagined at first. But these village forests, just as they once were in Japan, are prolific producers of matsutake. And so it's been a productive form of enterprise for local people.
Well, I was going to say what sounds really interesting about that, especially in Lapland, is when you're talking about foraging for berries, you know, traditionally, you know, that's part of the sort of local diet. You know, you do that for your sustenance. But to introduce this idea of, oh, and in our same woods, there is this mushroom that, you know, somewhere, you know, thousands of miles from here, someone wants to pay enormous sums of money for. Like, you introduce an element of commerce to it that has to be super interesting when combined with sort of the traditional, you know, subsistence foraging that's happening there.
Well, let me first say how impressed I was when I saw, you know, it was September when I went, that's the mushroom season, but people mm-hmm. had supplies of wood to last through the winter, the most enormous wood collections. And they had put mm-hmm. aside potatoes. They had hunted moose and put it in the freezer. They had done an amazing job of putting together the kind of subsistence that they would need, especially for the very long, cold winters. Yeah. So mushrooms and berries that people put away, tubs of berries that then they could use in those cold winter months when a little sweetness is especially appreciated. And mm-hmm. a mushroom had come before, the porcini or sep, the king boleet, we sometimes call it in the U.S., which is very valued in other parts of Europe, had come in sure. as a commercial mushroom to this area. So people were already trying to ship out these boleets to sell on a commercial market. So matsutake came after that, but with even better prices than the boleets were having, at least at that time. And so it was an exciting moment for thinking about mushrooms.
Yeah. Tell me about when you were with pickers and hunters in Oregon. Who were you with?
So most of the pickers camp during the period of the mushroom season, and they establish camps. The Forest Service has created a very large camp for mushroom pickers, but there are also some private camps, and people bring not just tents, but a whole kind of little camping establishments where you can put a wood stove and other things in there to stay warm in what sometimes is quite cold. And there were collections of people from Laos and Cambodia. My research before I started this mushroom project was in Southeast Asia. So I was particularly excited to meet all these Southeast Asians in the forests of Oregon. And there were Hmong and Mien and Khmer and Lao and even some small ethnic groups like Cham and Akha, where people were there in quite large numbers. And most of them took advantage of this period to see other people that they didn't normally see, to get what many people saw as the health benefits of being out in the forest looking for mushrooms, at the same time as they were attempting to get a serious part of their annual income from these months of the mushroom harvest. So it was a wild and kind of wonderful scene.
And these, the folks you mentioned, were they migrants, workers, or you mentioned refugees earlier?
Yes, so most of them are refugees, that they came from the U.S. Indochina War, that we sometimes call it the Vietnam War, but it was also in Laos and Cambodia. Mm-hmm. All the people that were displaced from that war, and many of them went to refugee camps in Thailand, and then in the 1980s, the U.S. opened its door to refugees from that American conflict. And so people came in and particularly were resettled in California, the ones who were involved in the mushroom picking in the Pacific Northwest. There were some from places as far away as North Carolina, and they brought specialty foods that people from North Carolina had, bamboo shoots that they had home canned for sales. Because you can imagine, this is a huge gathering of Southeast Asians, and sometimes trucks would come with fresh crab and other delicacies to sell to the mushroom pickers gathered there. And in the U.S. Forest Service camp, they even had a little pop-up restaurant that sold pho and ran completely on a generator because, of course, it's completely off the grid. So it was amazing to see a little center of Southeast Asian culture in the woods in Oregon.
Yeah. Do you have particular mushroom hunters that you remember being with and what they taught you about that experience?
Well, let me say, these mushrooms are not easy to find. It is very rare that you see an actual mushroom. What you look for is a tiny crack or disturbance in the pine needles. And I'll admit, when I started, the pickers would have to say to me, okay, look around you. How about right between your feet? Can you see something? So I had a learning curve there before I could even find them. And I never became the kind of expert picker that some of the people who were really amazing were. And I'll have to say, those people who had experience, particularly some of the kinds of fighters who had spent a lot of time in the woods in Southeast Asia and therefore never got lost because they knew how to navigate. They knew how to notice what was around them. For me, it was a real eye-opener to think about even tiny pieces of garbage like an abandoned cigarette pack. As an American, my first instinct was to pick that stuff up because it's not supposed to be in the woods. But it turned out that remembering that cigarette pack when you're trying to find your way and you realize I've passed this cigarette pack before.
That's your breadcrumb trail.
Yes, exactly.
Your cigarette pack trail.
Yes. So sometimes I was really grateful for these tiny little traces of human activity. And of course, people are looking for fallen trees or other kinds of signs. They're parts of this landscape that are quite flat. And so there, it's really hard to hold on to your navigation. So that's one of the biggest skills, as well as remembering where the mushrooms are, that this is a mushroom that grows with particular trees. It's attached to the roots of the trees. And so if you can remember where that tree is and go back, maybe in a month or in a year, that tree may have mushrooms at it again. But it's a big memory job to remember the places where you found mushrooms last time.
Were there folks who ate them in a particularly notable way or who taught you about eating them? Or they often not eat them because they were too valuable to eat? Like, what was that part of it like?
There are always extra mushrooms. There are lots of mushrooms that really don't have much market price. Maybe some little worms have been eating them, or some side has been frozen, or they're a little bit too mature for the market. They're still delicious, even though they're flawed. So there's tons of mushrooms around in any mushroom camp. And one of the recipes that I found most delicious and surprising was perhaps you've eaten green papaya salad at a Thai restaurant.
Sure.
It's a spicy vinegar dish. Well, take away the papaya and put raw matsutake mushrooms in instead.
Oh my.
It's quite amazing.
So with fish sauce and lime
right.
and a little bit of sugar and chilies and wow.
So that was a recipe that I really was surprised by. And then all kinds of soups, especially the kinds of clear and spicy soups that, again, you might get at a Southeast Asian restaurant. Try them with matsutake. Soup brings out the matsutake smell and flavor very beautifully.
Oh, that sounds amazing, amazing, amazing. And what was your first experience cooking with them?
Well, I started my research on a bumper year for matsutake. And so I found lots.
Oh, lucky. And
I was very lucky, as I saw later in many years where the mushrooms weren't nearly as good. And so I cleaned and chopped a whole lot of them And I made a Chinese-style stir-fry with a bunch of vegetables to eat over rice. And the smell was so strong, I couldn't stand it. So I ended up throwing out the whole frying pan of food.
It was hurting my heart.
Yeah. Just eating the rice. I thought, oh dear, I don't know how to cook these. And so I had two big, those paper shopping bags full of matsutake, and I brought them to a Japanese friend of mine, and she was completely thrilled. She'd never seen so much matsutake in her life because where she lives in Japan, they're rare and valuable. So she started cooking right away that day, and she said, your first problem was don't use oil. Oil or butter, even worse, changes the flavor and smell of matsutake. And so you need to find a recipe, she argued, where you don't use any oil or butter. And she said, the way she had learned is don't use a knife. Use your fingers to tear the mushroom because even the metal of the knife can change the smell and the flavor of matsutake.
Oh, interesting.
And so she cooked matsutake by just dry grilling it and then putting a little citrus juice on it. It was the most delicious thing. I was crazy about it from that moment.
Hmm. So you mentioned a few times that they grow typically in forests that have been destroyed or damaged or at least disturbed when the pines come in after other things have sort of been burnt or knocked down. And that's a big part of the book, the sort of metaphor of matsutake. I mean, the title is literally the mushroom at the end of the world. Tell us a little bit about why you wanted to study these mushrooms as a sort of a symbol. Like, what's their symbolic or metaphoric value to you?
Well, first, maybe I should say that it's the people who drew me into the life of the mushroom.
Mm.
The kind of enthusiasm, not just pickers, but buyers and scientists and foresters that they all had for the mushroom. And they brought me to appreciate the life of the mushroom itself, and particularly the way that it grows like pine in these mineral soils, often in eroded places, places where there were volcanoes or mudslides, or where humans are raking all the leaves and needles to create green manure for their fields. They're also cutting firewood, making charcoal. In some sense, ecologically, they're denuding the forests of nutrients because they're taking them for other things. But it happens that that ecology is really good for pine trees if they live with matsutake, that the combination of pines and matsutake working together are able to handle those denuded ecologies and create life inside them. That situation was really surprising to me. Not only that human disturbance created this rich ecology, but also that when, after World War II, a lot of these village forests were abandoned, the matsutake and the pine disappeared. So that situation where often we think in the U.S. that allowing forests to grow is always the best thing to do with them. But in this case, you lost a particular ecology that was very diverse and rich, that was created together with a certain degree of human disturbance. It doesn't mean that all human disturbance
trash our forests and see what comes out.
Right, but exactly. But this particular kind where villagers maintained their forests in a way that allowed them to get firewood and fertilizer out of them turned out to have a rich ecology, including these matsutake mushrooms that they valued very much. So that was very good to think with because I was so surprised. I hadn't expected a situation where a certain degree of human disturbance might create a rather rich biodiversity. I mean, a different one than if you just let the forest go.
Yeah. This is a very clear reminder that we're part of the same ecosystem and it all exists in connection with one another. And so it's important for us to remember that just as much as anything else.
That's right.
This has been so wonderful, Anna. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Anna Lohenhaupt-Singh is the author of The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibility of life in capitalist ruins. Well, that's our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you're suddenly feeling a craving for mushrooms, just go to splendidtable.org. We have a whole bunch of our favorite mushroom recipes pulled together there. And hey, again, if you have any cooking questions for us, Record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Can't wait to hear from you. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.